This is September 14th, 2005, continuation of the ongoing interview for oral history with Emeritus Professor Daniel Kanana. We stopped last time with some broken pickup sticks, and we'll pick up today with your observations about your access to, or lack of access to, libraries at high school.
You know, I keep going back to the question of to comparing the facilities and privileges of black children in black schools with those of white children in white schools. And here's another case where, in fact, the whole concept that there could be a place where you could go and borrow a book and read it and take it back, I didn't even know. I didn't even know the word library even as I entered high school.
Really?
Let alone be exposed to one. There was none attached to the school. There wasn't anyone in the whole sprawling township of Kronstadt. And when eventually, now I don't know whether this was the department, the provincial department of education, but eventually a library was installed at one of the high schools. Actually, it was in the Catholic church, but then it was one of the schools. It wasn't a high school. There was only one high school, the one where I was. At some primary school, there was a library installed. And then our teacher told us about this. You know, there's a place where you can go and just take out a book and sign your name, read it, and take it back. Oh, it was the first time I heard about that. Now, if you put that in the context of the fact that even the books that we needed to study from, we, as black students, had to buy them. We had to buy them while white students did not have to do that. And of course, they were always exposed to books, libraries. And one mustn't forget, too, that more white students had the privilege of being in a home where there were books around them, where there was some tradition of reading adults, just reading books. Now, in a place like Kronstadt, I don't think even among whites that there were too many such, but there were some. Among us, blacks, your parents had a Bible, a hymnal, and catechism, and so on. That was the extent of existence of books in the home. You had your school books, which you carried to school every day and back every afternoon. That was the extent of your contact with books. So to have a place at last where you could go and not have to buy the book, but have it for a few days, 2 weeks, or whatever, read it and then take it back without paying anything, that was a very, very novel thing, highly appreciated. So, I want to emphasize that the word library was not even in my vocabulary.
Was this a library that was open, was it just for black children, or was this a library that everybody used?
No, it was for black children. After all, I'm talking about a facility existing in an exclusively black residential area.
Okay.
Called, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, that black residential areas were called locations.
You did mention
So it's
that.
A location. So this was the pattern. It was like that where I grew up in Edenville. It was like that at Kronstadt, blacks here, and then some kind of no man's land that you cross, mm-hmm. Barrier to get to the white. So we didn't have the right to use their facilities, even if we could really, we would have taken the long journey to a library in town,
mm-hmm.
if it were made available, accessible to us. No, this one was in the black area, and it was a minimal thing. It was really not a very big functional library, but you know, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we're still in the 1930s.
We are still in the 1930s, and I'd say late 30s, because, you know, after all the delays for me to go to Kronstadt High School because my brother was going and my parents couldn't afford to have us both,
right,
in that relatively more expensive situation. I talked about that. And I did mention, I believe, that my first year at Kronstadt-Bandu High School was 1938,
mm-hmm.
when it could have been 1936.
Right.
So yes, we're still kind of late 30s at this time.
Okay.
I think we're getting close enough, though, to 1940. I may be going back and forth.
Uh-huh.
One thing I don't know if I mentioned, maybe on and off, was just the abject poverty that we were in.
This is side two of tape number three of the oral history interview with Professor Daniel Kanana. You were speaking about the poverty.
Yes. one element of this that I should mention, I don't think I mentioned it before, is the psychological effect on you as somebody who's carrying your poverty around or just on your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you just had to get used to the fact. And of course, maybe you didn't really have to carry so much of the psychological thing, because you were not the only one in your community,
mm-hmm.
in the environment where you lived. There were so many others like you. There were some who were probably even worse than you. So, it just left some scars psychologically, I think, you know, that you were having this to cope with at the same time.
Scars in the sense that repressed anger or discouragement? Or
the scars in the sense, for example, you know, how it also, you might not, you're fighting against feeling ashamed of being the way you look.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, it's more, I think, the psychological that places, that you have this burden.
Mm.
Over and above the fact that your being in school demands attention, demands energy, demands that you devote yourself to your studies, etc., your mind is from time to time, or maybe even all the time, maybe sometimes you know, subconsciously absorbed with this mm-hmm. handicap that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, you know, we did survive. I mean, that was the main thing. And by the way, I should then re-emphasize something that I know I said earlier, quite a bit earlier maybe, of casualties. Casualties in the sense of people who had to drop out
yes.
of school because of these conditions. So, so in fact, going through school was a kind of a battle that you were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And you won or you lost.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me that later, much later, and I'll come back to this story here, especially in fact when I started teaching poetry, examined the poetry, and it was poetry written by black people, by Africans, mostly they were teachers. And, you know, I wrote a book called Heroic Poetry of the Basotho. Heroic poetry which had to do with wars, real wars,
mm-hmm.
With victories, losses, with casualties, with self-praise by returned warriors from battle, etc., etc., by the village poet, you know, creating oral poetry for them, in praise of them, etc., etc. You know, just that sort of atmosphere where a warrior was someone who was laying his life on the line for his people, for his community. So victory was something to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of celebration included, as I just said, the composition of praises by the village poet or by the person himself, because many of these, in fact I remember one of them was a chief, kind of king of the tribe, who was both the king and an outstanding warrior and a wonderful poet. And so he would come back from battle and praise himself. It was good to feel good and praising himself. Now, I found that then teachers who started writing poetry very often devoted poems to successful blacks who got careers, who became teachers, who became, you know, later on maybe doctors. Because of these difficulties, because it was a battle, you had gone through a battle or war in your life that you had to win or to lose. And by getting that education, getting that diploma, certificate, and so on, you were a warrior, you were like a warrior who went to battle and returned victorious.
Oh.
And in fact, even the metaphors that the poet used were war metaphors. And not only that, but also the fact that, and I mentioned this earlier, that a, quote, educated young man, even little boy in the community,
yes.
was a boon to everybody,
mm-hmm.
who could call them, come and read me a letter, come and write a letter. Come here, little boy, come and read the Bible here for the congregation before I start preaching, you know, all that stuff. Which then meant that you were expected, or at least you were a potential boon to your community by having completed your studies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you came back, Mr. Teacher, you were Mr. Teacher for everybody, and so on and so forth, to say nothing about, and you see, people had to go overseas for a long time to get even a pre-university certification. They couldn't get in South Africa, blacks.
Mm-hmm.
To say nothing about medicine, studying to be a doctor, people had to go overseas, to Scotland, to wherever, you know, they could get sponsors, people who sponsored them. Come back, you belong to the whole community, you know, you're a blessing to the whole community, and so on. So But back now to we as young people trying to get education, we were warriors in a war. And either we became casualties by having to drop out because the system you're struggling against had defeated you.
Uh-huh.
Or you persevered and you won. And you had won your battle. You had won the war that you entered, and you had the reward of having your certificate. Well, it was nothing. Of course, there were certificates and diplomas. The thing was what you had got in here in your head,
mm-hmm.
and which again makes me make another comparison that grades. You didn't go to get grades, you went to get education.
Yes.
If you got the education, grades came automatically. You didn't go fighting, you know, reporting somebody to the dean, you know, he failed me. No. We went to school to get knowledge and so on. So back to the fact we are in a battlefield here, we're fighting a war. And poverty was one of the things that were dragging us down
mm-hmm.
as we were fighting this war.
Are you approaching graduation from high school at this point?
Let me first make a little correction here. and that's another story. In my, you know, the time that I was in school, the time that we're talking about, and for a long time after that, I don't know how it is now today in South Africa. This may seem, trivial, but it's not. We did not talk about somebody coming out of high school as graduating. The term graduate was reserved for when one got their first university degree. Then you were said to graduate, and it was something that if you had got through your high school and you have got your university entrance diploma and so on, you were you know your beacon. What was pulling you forward was things like, when I get my bachelor's degree, I will graduate. That was a fantastic term to be used of you because you were now BA, BSc, what have you. And then from then on, of course, each level, like master's, you were graduating again. And then doctorates, PhDs, you're graduating, and so on. And so also with we didn't have any outfit like gowns and caps and so on. No. Since, again, you were striving to see yourself one day graduating as a bachelor and having this gown, being, invested with his gown and so on in the cap. So in a sense, and, I'll be forgiven for saying this, I hope, what I see with the use of these things in this culture, for example, I think there are even graduations from kindergarten, right?
Yes, there are.
It's a trivialization. It's a trivialization of what really used to be one of the magnets that were pulling you, because by the time you graduate by getting a bachelor's degree, you will really have fought a major battle, etc. Sorry, I had to make this digression.
Yes.
Because, we didn't even have any formality. Once you were told you had passed, and your certificate was going to come in the mail to you. So, yes, we're near, excuse me, let's see, 38, 39. You know, I think I may have, was 38, I think this question came up before, where I wasn't quite sure whether it was 37 or 38 that I first went to, it was 38, okay. Okay, so 39, second year, and 40 then, since the junior certificate took 3 years, I received my junior certificate in 1940. Now, that's, I was passing then the equivalent of middle school, and then entering high school proper, which was called matriculation.
Okay.
And you spent 2 years, and if you did matriculate, that was then facilitated your entry into university to start your studies.
When you finish matriculation.
Matriculation, yes, uh-huh. Yes. But you did get a separate diploma for finishing this first part that I finished in 1940, what was called junior certificate, and the certificate was JC, you had passed JC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and matriculation, you could get matriculation proper, or you could get a senior certificate, which was SC. Now, it was while studying for the my first year in matriculation, is sometimes mm-hmm. called, that it was necessary for me to go to Johannesburg to find work, because the lack of facilities was just too great. But, you know, something that I missed along the way, again having to do with A.C. Jordan, is that while he was teaching at Kronstadt High School, he suddenly was just consumed with the zeal to study privately while teaching. He had a BA, bachelor's degree, and he decided to study as he was teaching also for a master's degree. What inspired him to do this was having seen a book, and I think it was the analysis of Zulu, one of the southern African languages. Analysis of Zulu, in fact, you know, quite a volume, analyzing the language linguistically, you know, a grammar, so mm-hmm. to say. Not a grammar really at that level, but at the level of really serious analysis of the language. Now, this was done by a white professor, C.M. Doak, Clement Doak, who was then teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And he had decided after, and he, I think he was the son of a missionary actually, so he was sort of physically with some, growing up with some people who spoke Zulu, etc., etc. Prior to that, he had been living a little further north, where he was again exposed to another Bantu language. But let's talk about the Zulu. Jordan sees this book, and because Clement Doak had decided that the way that was used to describe African languages, Bantu languages, grammatically, to analyze them grammatically, up to that point, was highly defective, in that the terminology, even the Latin structures of analyzing language, was being imposed on languages that had absolutely no such structures as would be described. I'll give you an example. For instance, if you talk about, let's say we're talking about preposition. And you say, well, you know, is there a preposition in these languages? Or let's say we talk about personal pronoun. Is there a personal pronoun? If so, how is it that, how is it used? Because sometimes when you're translating a sentence, you hear, as you know, with your English ear and training, when you translate what a Zulu just said, John went away. Your translation say, John, he went away. John, he went away. Mm-hmm. Now, so what do you do? I mean, you can't say subject and then pass on to the verb. You have to say subject, and then what do you do with this thing that is bothering you, that says you should say John, he went away, and things like that. Now, without going into much detail of that, I mean, there were so many of these that Doak said, we need a terminology, linguistic terminology, that arises from these languages. Look at them and see what they're telling you. And he came up in 1933 with a volume called Bantu Linguistic Terminology, which was a watershed for the description of South African Bantu languages. Okay, so he applied this method to several languages, Lamba and then Zulu and so on. Jordan looks at this and then he says, I'm a black person. I am a thoroughbred Xhosa person. And if this white man can do such a beautiful job of analyzing our languages as blacks, I will analyze my own language and go one better than him. And that was his inspiration for doing his MA by private study, in which he was analyzing his mother tongue, the Xhosa language. So, you know, that's another thing that shows you who he was, what he was, and what an inspiration he could be.
So did you know, while you were in high school working on your JC, that A.C. Jordan was doing this?
Yes, I got to know that. And and it was something that we talked about quite a lot when finally I joined him at the University of Cape Town. But now, I don't know, you might correct me, remind me if I'll be repeating myself here, because it was while I was doing my first year matriculation, that he wrote his novel, his first novel, in Xhosa, in his mother tongue. Did I talk about that?
You did not.
Well, it turned out to be one of the best books ever written in an African language up to that point. Hmm. He wrote a marvelous novel based on places that people knew, places where he himself had gone to school, and so on. His characters were all there. I mean, this was just such a fantastic book in Xhosa, in his language. That, you know, you heard stories of people, older people, for example, who didn't know how to read, just gathering together and asking a young man, student, teacher to read it for them, to just read, and they, you know, and how they were reacting like an oral audience, you know, and exclaiming and so on. That book was so wonderful.
What was the title of the book?
It was Ingumbo Yeminyanya. Ingumbo Yeminyanya, which translates into the wrath of the ancestors.
The wrath?
The wrath of the ancestors.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And a really tremendous book. It was later translated into English. Much, much later. I mean, it was after he was gone. But, you know, he wrote that book in 1940. Now, this would have been my last year in the JC certificate. In my first year of matric, we were visited by inspectors, school inspectors, who, you know, just came any time, just pounced on teachers to see how they're doing with the classes. It was one black and two whites, or two blacks and one white, I don't remember now. They come to, they go into different classes, and they come to his class, and he was teaching at that time in this first year matric. They come in, he opens the door, he lets them in, and, you know, of course we get up, as we used to have to do. When a dignitary comes in, until you're told to sit down, we sit down. And Jordan introduces himself. And one of these blacks said to him, "Are you the author of Ingumbo Yeminyanya?" And he says, "Yes," you know, with a kind of shy smile. And this man shakes his hands almost out of its socket. You know, he's so excited to meet the writer of this marvelous book.
Were you in the class when that happened?
Yes, yes.
You were there.
I was there. I saw it happening. So it was just incredible. So now, I was at the point of indicating that this was the year when I had to leave school to go to Johannesburg to find work. I visited Kronstadt a few times and never missed the chance to go to the school, just to be there. Jordan had used me as an example very often. I didn't know that, but he told me that when I was studying privately, because then I continued my education by private study.
Oh, in Johannesburg?
While I was working in Johannesburg. And I decided that I've got to finish this university entrance certificate. Now, studying like that, it was easier for me to do it as a senior certificate, as SC. And so that's what I enrolled for, and I studied, and I passed it. I don't know how Jordan was able to be following my career the way he was, because then I enrolled to study by private study for the bachelor's degree, for the BA.
Oh, you did? Private study?
Private study. Private study. But you see, what I told you, Bob, about that light beckoning at you, you know, the beacon light that says, come, come, and so on. And since, like, you are going to graduate for the first time in your life when you get a bachelor's degree, the fact that for the first time in your life you're going to have a gown draped over you and a cap over when you get your bachelor's degree, those were very, very important. And but again, I've got to emphasize that it was the knowledge, it was driving you not to say by hook or crook. It was saying, I've got to study hard, I've got to study hard to pass in order to earn that place. Now, I'm mentioning this because when I asked for, you know, papers to be registered with the University of South Africa as an external or private student who was going to write the BA first year exam at the end of that year, and they sent me the forms, and you know, I filled in my name and one or two other details that were required, and then where it said for what degree, when I wrote BA next to my name, it was as if I already had it. It was just so exciting. So when I pass this, that's what I will have after my name. You know?
Thrilling.
Thrilling. Just that image that, you know, this is the reward that is waiting for me. I will be able to write BA after my name. So I was doing private study, you know, then they send you the books that you need, the list, not the books, the list of books for each subject that you enrolled in. And at that time, that was it. Send you the books required for whichever subjects you've enrolled for, and then tell you the date of the exam at the end of the year. Between that and that, you are on your own.
Now, this was from the University of South Africa.
That's where they did have conduct external exams for degree students, yeah.
Okay, and now was this a segregated school in that this university was just for black students? This is side one of tape four of the September 14th, 2005 interview with Emeritus Professor Daniel Kanana.
Well, you know, it was University of South Africa was at that time a university that only dealt with external students. Were sent your information, your book, the books you required, the date of the exam. You didn't know who else had enrolled. In fact, when you got to, or if you got to, well, when, the end of your, usually BA would take 3 years of study if you passed every year.
Mm-hmm.
When you got to that end and you were due for graduation, you didn't even graduate at the University of South Africa. You were delegated to some university that was affiliated. You see, for example, what is now University of Fort Hare, which is largely black, traditionally, when you studied there at that time, the University of the what was then Fort Hare College was affiliated to the University of South Africa. So when you graduated from Fort Hare at that time, your certificate was going to be University of South Africa certificate, affiliated college, Fort Hare. You see that? It's like a federal organization
mm-hmm.
with affiliated smaller organizations and so on.
I see.
Yeah. So that's how it was at that time.
So you had matriculated, and then you were having to work on your BA degree on your own.
Right. As I did indeed also with the second year of my matriculation, since I left school without completing the matriculation. So I continued then doing private study for the bachelor's degree as well. And I did several jobs. I was working in different places, living with different people, etc. When one day I got a letter from A.C. Jordan. What had happened in the meantime, while I was in Johannesburg, he had got his master's, he had successfully applied for a job as lecturer at Fort Hare College, which was then still affiliated to University of South Africa,
mm-hmm.
As professor. You know, because there was an opening there, and he successfully applied for that. He stayed there for 1 year, and while he was there, an opening for a black person to teach Bantu languages, African languages, specifically to teach Xhosa at the almost exclusively white University of Cape Town, this job was advertised. A.C. Jordan applied for it, was called for an interview, and was appointed.
Oh my gosh. At a white university?
At a white university. This was... I don't think I can recall the exact year when this happened, but we're still in the first half of the 40s when all these things are happening. I think it was still before 1945, let's say, just for a rough time period. And now, you may recall, and I hope I'm right in remembering that I did say this way back, where near the beginning of our interview. If I've not, then let me just say it. It doesn't matter if I'm repeating it. That when I was in standard 6, somewhere in the standards there, and I'm trying to remember which one it was. Yeah, standard 6, I think. Our teacher told us about a black person who had been hired by the University of the Witwatersrand, which was an exclusively white university, to teach white students Zulu, an African language. Now, what happened then was the teacher was saying there are some white people who were demonstrating, protesting against their children, their white children, being taught by a black person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you do know... I mean, you know, at that time, the only black person they saw was their gardener or their cook or their nanny and so on who came in through the back door, even if they had to come and make the beds, you know, work in the house, and so on. That was the only black person they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who came in the morning had to be on time, make them morning coffee and so on. And then late afternoon disappear. They had no clue where he lived or she lived. That was the kind of black person they knew. Now suddenly for one to come and be a colleague of the white lecturers and professors at Witwatersrand University, and for their children to sit there in front and this man in front of them, they were rioting. So I'm getting the impression that I did not narrate this earlier.
You did not.
Yes. And our teacher said, you know, it's because there's a black man who has been appointed to teach in that university and to teach white students. Well, the protest didn't last very long. The man stayed. And I'm telling this in the context of A.C. Jordan not being the first black person to teach in an exclusively white university.
Uh-huh.
That there had been this earlier experience many years before. Having started this story about, let me just finish this little section about this man who was appointed to teach at the Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg.
Uh-huh.
Because it links up with Professor Doak, whom I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And who was the head of the African studies area, including languages and some African languages, Bantu languages and so on. And it was he who engineered the appointment of the man who was then Mr. B. W. Vilakazi, Zulu through and through, who was a teacher and had his bachelor's degree teaching somewhere in Natal, I don't know what school, but who then and a very proud Zulu about his language and customs and culture and so on, the same way as Jordan was, with his Xhosa culture,
mm-hmm.
and language and customs and so on and so forth. And he was the right person for going to teach language there and inspire the students with the culture from which it came. And he was a terrific poet, writing his poetry in Zulu. So, now I think by the time that he started writing the poetry, he was already appointed to the University of Witwatersrand. His story is another object lesson on race relations, starting with white parents protesting him being appointed there, to the university itself continuing to regard him as a lower species of university employee,
mm-hmm.
and never the you know, people who were teaching were called either lecturer, which was divided into junior lecturer for someone just entering the teaching, and then the junior lecturer, then senior lecturer, then you're stuck there until maybe the head of the department dies and so on, because then you might become a professor. But nevertheless, forget about that. The point is that the categories of teachers at Witwatersrand University were the lecturer category three steps,
mm-hmm.
and professor category and so on. For Mr. Vilagazi, they created a new term to describe his position, which was not applied to anybody else. And that term was language assistant. Language assistant. Now, he went on like that, Doak went on like that. Doak was getting quite embarrassed by the fact that this able man, this man who had, in fact, over several years now, proven his capability, his expertise, his knowledge, his excellence in teaching, including his ability, which Doak used to ask him to do from time to time, to stand in as an administrator of the department when Doak had to be away.
Really?
Yeah. Including, I mean, running the department and so on. And Doak said, you know, tried over and over at the university meetings of council and so on for this, for Vilakazi's position to be regularized. This man has to be called the way that we call anybody else who is teaching students in this university. And the university sort of just balked. They got to the point where they said, okay, we'll call him senior language assistant. How about that? And we'll increase his salary. Senior language assistant. Doak was not satisfied at all. They continued that way. And meanwhile, something else was happening, that Mr. Vilagazi then enrolled for the master's degree at the university itself.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know how that was arranged. He must have probably done the way that Jordan enrolled to do private study.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But he was enrolling with the same university that was refusing to give him the title that he deserved.
Mm-hmm.
Got the master's degree. He was still language assistant. He enrolled to do the PhD in the same university that he got. And they still refused to change his title. And when Doak, you know, in utter despair and so on, gets to them and says, this is a disgrace. We've got to give this man the title he deserves. And they said, no, well, you know, we'll raise his salary substantially, but he'll still be senior language assistant. Dr. Vilagazi, an author, a poet, teacher that he was, unfortunately died prematurely.
Hmm.
I think he was about maybe 37 when he died.
Oh my.
Very young. I don't know of what. So this situation never got resolved as to what the university, will the university ever, you know, see the light and know and do what, and do the right thing, you know, do what needs to be done. So, you know, I had to tell the story also because very often the institution hides behind some law and so on and say, well, it's not us, you know, it's that law there that's preventing us from doing this or that.
Mm.
And when that law is not there and they have to face it, then their own racism comes to the front.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was just blatant racism on the part of the all-white university of the Witwatersrand. So back to A.C. Jordan, and this was a long digression. Mm-hmm. I had to make it, because all the time I thought I had told the story of Dr. Vilagazi, but I had not. Yes, he too, now for him there were no protests, but later, after he had taught them maybe for a few years, two white female students confessed to him that when they originally joined his class, they were sent there as spies by the government.
Really?
Yes. For, I don't know, for his politics, or for that matter, for any transgression that they may say, we told you, you know, that black man, you know, that's why we don't want them here, etc. And they were to spy on him, and they got to love him, they got to like his work, they got to just be, you know, like, well, why should we be spying on this man? Such a good man, such an excellent teacher, and so on. And they confessed to him afterwards. So for him, it had been an attempt to sabotage him by the law. But then I should also emphasize, I don't know what the time is at this time. I don't have my watch on me. Okay, so are we on again now?
Yes,
okay.
We're on.
You know, at the University of Cape Town, one thing that maybe will be a good point to stop was that only in this department where African languages, Bantu languages, were taught,
mm-hmm.
was there a black person teaching. No one in psychology, no one in any science department, no one anywhere, which really meant that it was an act of desperation, shall we call it, by the university. If they had a white person who knew Xhosa as well as Jordan, who knew the Xhosa culture, language, etc., they probably would have employed him or her rather than a black person. That's the what you get from the fact that there were students, brilliant students, blacks and colors, who graduated in the English department. Would the Department of English ever consider them as lecturers there? No, never, at the University of Cape Town. So here we're dealing with maybe I should bring in also the thing about the university apartheid, covert in University of Cape Town, University of Witwatersrand. But let's stop there. I think I'm trying to find a good kind of period, you know, full stop,
uh-huh.
for us to stop at. And I think that maybe here, where we have seen people who were sent to spy on Jordan, ultimately become his disciples, his students who love him,
uh-huh.
and confess to him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary.
Yes.